Very good.
Okay, no questions again. Woohoo!
Very good. Oops, come on, stand up. You lazy teddy bear. Okay, go to sleep then. Good night. Come on. Okay, so here we have tonight's questions. Here we go. Wow, strange. Dear Ajahn, please help me to understand what has happened. Nothing has happened. Thanks, Ajahn. Right? Okay. I adopted your good enough method. I went into a very blissful stage. Isn't it nice? It is like an expanding sphere with strong energy. It was getting stronger and stronger, as if I was going to explode. It's exciting. After that, I went to a very still stage, which I only have my own breath. Strange thing happens. It seemed that the sphere was collapsing to zero. My breath went to zero. Please help me to understand what happened. Thanks, Ajahn. What happened was you said good enough. You went into a very blissful stage. You had an expanding sphere with strong energy. It got stronger and stronger, and after that you went very still. And then it collapsed into zero. That's what happened, that's what you told me. But look, is it good enough? That's that method, which is you're letting go, you don't want anything. When you're good enough, as we just chanted, when you're contented and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. That's what we chanted. And that's very powerful teachings there. So it's good enough, you don't demand anything. You're contented, easily contented. The very fact you can sit meditation just for, you know, these few days. Wow, that's such an amazing thing you can do that. Just you come here, don't worry about enlightenment or jhanas, this is good enough. When someone's so contented and happy just being here, then amazing things happen. Because when you start wanting things and trying to get things, then you're just sitting still under the mango tree. And pop, 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 all these amazing mangoes just fall down. That's actually what happens. So, again and again, those are good questions because they encourage other people. When it's good enough, when you let go, when you don't want anything, you stay in the present moment, you're happy being here, everything else just comes to you. Dear Ajahn, can a non-Buddhist doing meditation for non-religion reasons attain jhana? Thank you. Yes, of course they can, but they become Buddhist afterwards. Ha ha ha. I was observing my breath and it went slow and then suddenly replaced by my pulse. I tried to observe that, but it's fast like disco song beat. Help! You know, people pay a lot of money to go to a disco, and you get it here for free. You know, sometimes people get very bored in the evening, or very... So you've got a disco. Boom, 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 boom. Now, number one, sometimes it could be excitement, because when things start to happen in meditation, you get excited, and that's when the pulse increases. And it's just, you know, just too much sort of expectation. So lower the expectation down and just relax. Then the pulse will go down. But don't relax too much, otherwise you're dead. That doesn't happen. But sometimes, that if this is an important piece of advice, sometimes when you're meditating, your breath is getting very peaceful, very nice, and then you start to get excited, you become aware of your heartbeat. And that is a real problem, because you can't calm your heartbeat down, otherwise you do die. So the heartbeat is something which is a problem. Once you can notice it, it's hard to get rid of. So the way to get rid of it is using a little technique, which is, you know, it is called focusing. Whatever you keep in the center of your screen of attention, that remains, and everything on the outside just vanishes. It's a simile of the TV set. When you first watch a TV set, a TV monitor, then you can see the screen and what's just beyond the screen. But you will notice after a few minutes that you can't even notice the screen anymore. You're actually inside. You know, your mind just fits in to the center of the screen, and anything on the outside just falls away. This is always what happens with whenever you focus on. So if you focus on the breathing, say the breathing is right in the center, then yes, you first of all you can feel the heartbeat, but it's not in the center, it's not the most important thing. The breath is most important, the heartbeat's over here somewhere. And after a few minutes you don't know when, but it just vanishes, it disappears. But if the heartbeat is your problem, the heartbeat is in the center and the breath vanishes. And that's the same actually if you have any other distractions, such as this sounds, you know, going on wherever you happen to be. And it sounds, but don't sort of make them a big problem, because if you do, the sounds are right in the center here, and everything else, all your peace, your stillness, all vanishes. So keep the peace and stillness in the center. You can hear the sound, but they're over here somewhere. But your main focus is on the stillness, and after a while the sounds, they vanish, you're not listening anymore. You can't hear anything. And many people can do that. You know, I remember just, you know, this man came up and said, it took me 3 years of married life to not be able to listen to my wife. Yes, she was speaking, but the words were over there somewhere. There wasn't a center of attention, he was saying. And those of you who are married know that sometimes that people are talking and they pretend to listen, but they're not. One of my Christian friends commented that Buddhism is unscientific because we believe the world has no beginning and no end, cyclic existence. According to him, physics says the universe had a start date and an end date. Is that true? No, as a physicist, theoretical physicist. Big Bang, fair enough. But before the Big Bang, there were other universes, other universe cycles. If you have one Big Bang, why not two? Why not three? Why not 100? Why not many, 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 many? And so that most physicists, they say, this is not the first universe, it won't be the last. But you know, human beings are really strange. They always think they're the center of things. You know, if it was China, it was the center of the world. But the Brits thought, no, 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 that was on the edge of the world somewhere. Europe was the center of the world. The middle land. And because people thought the world was flat. And that's all there was. And then suddenly someone found out the world was round and no one was in the center of the earth. But then we thought at least planet Earth was the center, you know, of the universe. And then science says that we are just on a pretty ordinary, nondescript galaxy, on the edges of it, not in the sort of the best suburbs of the galaxy. You know, you notice the outer suburbs of any city, all the poor places where the degenerates live, and that's us, on a very nondescript arm of the Milky Way. And the Milky Way is just an ordinary galaxy. What it is we're not special. And we always thought that human beings were special. Now, first of all, excuse me, white man, we were the superior. The ones were born to rule the whole world. And no, we were just men, not women, by the way, men. And then you found that, you know, whether you're Asian, whether you're European, whether you're African, that doesn't make any difference. And now we realize that, you know, we're all human beings. No, and then we had genderism. We thought, you know, men, yeah, you know, we can rule. Women just can't do it. Just they're too emotional to be in charge. And you know, that's absolutely stupid. You know, now at least we've got rid of genderism. We've got ageism as well. That, you know, you have to be old to be in authority. And now it's great to have young people in authority. I still say that one of the great successes of our Buddhist society here in Perth was, what, I don't know how many years ago now, maybe 15, 16 years ago, We had our elections for our committee of our Buddhist Society in Western Australia. It's a democratic institution which I fix every year by choosing who I want to be. Very similar to the Hong Kong form of democracy. Only I'm the Politburo or whatever of China. But so one year, you know, I thought, no, I want someone young, you know, who's going to be our president. So we got Sol. He's only about 22, 23 or something. At the time he became the president of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. A lot of people thought, what are you doing someone so young for? Doesn't know what he's doing, has got no experience in the world. But he was the guy who started the podcasts and started getting us on the internet. And you know, it really was one of the first podcasts because he was actually interviewed by the BBC, you know, from London, because he was one of the pioneers. The Buddhist Society of Western Australia was one of the pioneers of podcasting. And that's why he got an interview from the BBC. So that's what happens when you get someone young. Okay, you get someone old, it's conservative, they will never do anything new, and they're always afraid. You know, young people, you know, they've just got ideas. And I remember in Malaysia, in Buddhist Gem Fellowship in Malaysia, they once told me, they say, they want the young people with all the ideas and the old people with all the money. Put those two together and you get things done. That is really good. So sometimes that you know, we think we're the centre of the universe, but we're not. And then we've got speciesism. We think humans are much more advanced than all animals. We're not. We're just so close together. And all the time we always think we're special. And now we think this universe is like the middle universe, the only universe. Like planet Earth was the only place where there was any life. And it's not true. This is not the first universe. It's not the last universe. And if any Christians comment that Buddhism is unscientific, cheapers, you know, that they really are. 5,000 years ago, this Earth was made. There's some God up there, you know, please prove there is a God. If he is, he's a pretty mean fellow. You know, allowing all these wars and Ebola to happen. You know, what sort of creator would make something like that? Do you think God pushed that over? No, it's absolutely crazy stuff. So, I mean, sometimes people who are Christians who do actually study science, they have a lot of tension inside of them. You know, what they believe and what they know are two different things. Thank you. Very wise. But I say the beginning and the end, the cycle of existence, that's actually what physics says. You know, I think it was the last time, it was Carl Epstein, UCLA. You know, he his theory was brain, B-R-A-N-E. And it was like, instead of string theory, it was membrane theory, just an advance on string theory. You may have heard that word, string theory. It's really weird stuff, but you've heard the name. Instead of a string, a membrane, like two dimensions. Strings is one dimension. And just basically just trying to conceptualize, you know, his equations, and equations of many, of actually membranes, and when they sort of cross, that's where the Big Bang happens. And a universe comes. And it, you know, and it happens many times. And obviously, why not? It's always the case, if it happens once, why not many times? It's one of the great arguments for reincarnation. You say, you know, if you've only got born once, well, that really is weird. Why just once? Why not twice? If it could happen once, can't it happen again? And again and again and again and again. It's really weird to think you're only born once. And anyway, you know, did I tell you the answer to the beginning of the world? I don't think I did. I've been telling a lot of people this recently, the last year or two, because that is one of those arguments which is so hard for people to understand. Now, where did this universe, not talking about other universes, begin? And they say, well, if there's a Big Bang, then what caused the Big Bang? You know, but if there was a cause of the Big Bang, what was before that cause? It's the old argument, if everything has a cause and God was that cause, what caused God? Where did God come from? The argument, it just is circular, it just goes back and back and back. That's the problem with beginnings. It's illogical. You can keep disproving it again and again and again. So the answer to that riddle is not that hard to explain. I thought I did say here about the ants on the football. Did I say that in the last couple of days? No, it must have been over in Bodhinyana. That this universe in which we're living in, it's a certain size. We know roughly how big this universe is. You know, it's 14 billion years old, so it's 14 billion light years. Sort of basic, imagine a sort of a sphere, 14 billion light years in diameter, and that's our universe. So we know it has a specific size. There's only a certain amount of universe. It's not infinite. But also we know the universe has got no edges to it. If you go far enough in this universe, you don't come across this wire fence like you see in Singapore with the guy with the gun saying, you know, you're not allowed to go in here. No more trespassing beyond this point. This is the end of the universe. Or a brick wall. Or a cliff which you fall over. You know, you don't have an end to this universe, but it's limited size. How on earth can that be? And as I remember having it explained when I was at university, it's a very simple explanation and it's easy to understand. And it was a simile of the ant crawling over the soccer ball. So the ant crawls over the soccer ball and he knows the soccer ball has only got a certain area, it's a limited area. If he keeps on walking, he keeps going over the place where he was before and explores the whole of the soccer ball very quickly. So it's limited area, but it has no edges to it. There's no beginnings or ends. So it's limited area with no edges. And that is how physicists understand this universe in which we live. It's got a limited space, doesn't go on forever. There's no edges to it. It curves around on itself. A universe which is limited, but with no boundaries. That is reality. Now we take it one step further. Time. Time, limited duration, but no edges to it. No beginnings and no ends. And that is the only solution which makes sense, which stops all problems. If there's a beginning, there has to be a cause before the beginning. Otherwise, why did the beginning happen? When there's no beginning, then there's no need for a God or a causality. And that is exactly the same as our universe. The reason that people think there's a God, the same reason why people thought there was a flat earth with edges to it, beginnings and ends of this earth, because they couldn't conceive the earth was a sphere. And we always thought that maybe this universe had some edge to it. I remember just thinking about that when I was a kid. What happens if you go far enough? Where can you find the edge of the universe? And if you get there, what is the edge of the universe? But it has no edge. And now we just take the next step, time. No beginning, no end. But it can't have a beginning or an end. No more this universe can have a beginning or an end. How can you conceive that? It doesn't exist. The same as time. No beginning, no end. And that is physics. And that means there's no need for a God. That is scientific. The rest is just mumbo jumbo. So, for a Christian to say Buddhism isn't scientific, they're just a hypocrite. Should we avoid thinking even happy things because it's craving, creating attachment, or is it only during meditation? If you're going to think, then think happy thoughts. But the best in meditation is not to think at all, especially in meditation. But outside you have to think. Outside you have to make decisions. Imagine that from now on you stopped all thinking and you go to work. And you don't know how to turn on the computer because you have to think to do that. You can't even get to work, but to get into the car you have to think. You won't even get out of bed because to get out of bed you have to think, I've got to get out of bed. You won't even remember how to breathe. Now, this is what you do when you meditate. You try and sort of lessen the thoughts. And then afterwards you can think when you need to think. And you can stop thinking when you don't want to think. You have power over thinking. Rather than most of you, thinking has power over you. Thinking controls you and runs you. You're a slave to it. Which means sometimes you have a thought, you don't want to think it, but it goes on and on and on. You want to go to bed at night, you want to go to sleep, and these thoughts keep worrying you because they control you. Now imagine if you knew how to, you know, when you need to think, you can think. I've had enough of that. I want to go to sleep now. I want to meditate. You can just do that. Turn it off. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a switch? You know, just like you switch on the light in your room, you can switch the brain off. And then when you want to work, you know, you've got to go to work, you make earn some money, turn the brain on. Okay, now I'm thinking. That's called meditation. Finding the thinking. Finding the switch. Meditation is to increase mindfulness and to make the knower stronger. And will be like, what will it be like when the knower is overpowered, stronger than the doer? Then you are free. When you're knower, and you're wise. You don't have to do when you don't want to. Number one, you won't get so tired. You're doing so much in life. And you'll be able to relax when the knower is stronger than the doer. And you won't be so obsessive about things. You just stop whenever you want to. So when mindfulness gets very strong and the doing gets very little, then you have much more fun in life. And you realize all that doing where you struggle with was hardly worth anything at all. That's why these days I try and do less and less. I delegate as much as I can. Let other people do it. Isn't it nice to delegate? So, but I still take the praise. And when it goes wrong, I say, well, I delegated to her, so it's her fault. So as I often say in these retreats, if you enjoy this retreat, the praise comes here. If there's any problems, go and see the manager. Or the caretaker. I only take the praise. I find it hard to tell when washing one's thoughts becomes actually feeding the thought process. Can you please explain? Okay, one way of doing this is put some space between you and the thoughts. I haven't taught that yet. No, on this retreat. So your thoughts are over here, and you, the watcher, the observer, is distant from them. And then you find you have some control over them. But you find that the thoughts actually consume you when you're right in the center of the thoughts. There's no space, there's no objectivity. And the simile is, again, watching the TV. And all the movies, because I remember when I was a student, we'd watch the movies, and always you'd watch some sort of horror movie or some drama, especially a horror movie. One of my favorite movies I used to see every year at Cambridge was Tarantula. They're really stupid movies about this little spider who was in some nuclear accident and mutated into this huge monster who was eating people. Tarantula. And so you can imagine tarantulas creeping up to eat somebody. And always some people get so involved in the movie. They'd shout out, "Hey, look out, behind you, tarantula." Have you seen people do that in the movies? Shout out. That movie was shot years ago. It was probably shot in Hollywood. You know, from Cambridge in England, they can't hear you in Hollywood. But you get so caught up in it, you actually start believing you're right there on the set, shouting at tarantula. You get involved in it. Now don't blame the girls, the boys, soccer match. Come on, shoot! Shoot, you idiot! They're playing Premier League in England. They can't hear you. But people get so involved, they think that they can actually tell that guy to shoot the ball or save it or pass or whatever. Why do you do that for? It's because, you know, you really get so sucked into the movie or the soccer match, it's like you think you're there. You know, you're there on the ground and close enough to tell that guy what to do. Now that's the same with thoughts. We get so involved in them that we actually start telling them, come on, think this way, do this, yes. Instead of actually separating yourself, it's just thoughts, it's rubbish, really. If you can put some space between you and the TV set, whereas it's only a TV match, it's only a soccer match on TV, it's probably a recording. Now, it's already over the match. So, you know, all your shouting is a waste of time. There's a movie, it's a replay, you know, that you can't sort of influence, you know, by what you say or what you do. Come on, quick. You know, you're going to make it. You know, all that thinking and all that willing and wishing is a waste of time, isn't it? The movie script has already been written. It's a waste of time being excited. You know what's going to happen in the end. It's really crazy. I remember I was on this flight, and I don't know if it was Singapore Airlines, it was a long time ago, because they had the screens came down, you know, not in front of the seats, the screen came right down. So it was right in front of me, I couldn't miss it. But I didn't have the headphones, and it was this movie called Armageddon. And it was the funniest thing I've ever seen. Next time, if you want to have an interesting experience, get a movie on the screen and don't have the headphones. And just have a look at it. Because I remember this scene, I was laughing my head off while everyone else was hanging on to the seats, what's going to happen next. They had apparently, you don't actually need them to work out what's going on. You know, just you can see everything. So they had, I think some meteorite was going to hit Earth or something. And you knew it's going to miss. Because it's a movie. You know, it always misses. But only at the last moment. You know, I knew the script before, you know, you can see at the end of it. And apparently they sent some spacecraft up to this meteorite. And then one of the spacecraft, you know, we had the hero inside, okay. Forget who the hero was. There was some really good-looking guy who had no experience running a spacecraft, but he was good-looking, and that was all you needed. And the spacecraft crashed onto the surface of this meteorite and exploded. And then it ran down the side of the mountain, and more sparks and flames and bangs. And then it went over the edge of a cliff, a long way down, and more bangs rolling down. It's about 10 minutes of explosions and pyrotechnics. And then it came to a halt. And it was silent. I could work that out. And then, inside the aircraft, which was totally mangled, a real mess, a hand came up. And this guy pulled himself up. He'd survived. With his hair cut, totally intact. Perfect. I burst out laughing. Everyone said, oh, relief, he survived. And people get involved in those movies. They really get engrossed in them. They're right there, they're supporting, and it's important, it's the end of the world. So number one, why do you like doing that? Why is it enjoyable to scare yourself that the world's going to end? There's all this tension of what's going to happen in the end. Because people like to suffer. You like to worry. You like to sort of have something to be concerned about. Anything but being peaceful. Basically. Now people watch all these soap operas on TV. What on earth do you do that for? Hadn't you got enough worries in your life? instead of worrying about something else. So now this is actually the simile of why we get involved in thoughts. When we don't have any separation, we get emotionally involved in those thoughts, like people get emotionally involved in a movie. But when you put some distance between you and your thoughts, you'll see them for what they are. They're just basically rubbish thoughts, and you can let them go pretty easily. They don't have any value. So you can watch the thoughts, but imagine the thoughts on a screen and you're sitting back. It's the same that, you know, if you're watching a movie, it's scary. You feel the seat in your, you know, your lounge room. You're sitting on a seat and it's not the movie. You're not going to be killed. It's not the end of the world. It's just a movie. It's a replay. And then you don't get scared. You don't have emotions. You don't cry when at last the lovers meet. I remember the old story of going with my girlfriend and my mate's girlfriend, a couple of other boys and their girlfriends, into the movies to watch West Side Story. And that was the movie in which Tony and Maria, from the opposite sides of the track, you know, one was, I think, a Latino, the other one was Italian. No, Italian and Puerto Rican. And they're not allowed to marry. But they fell in love. And both were, you know, their brothers were members of gangs who fought each other. And they wouldn't allow Tony and Maria to get together either. And something happened. I think Tony killed Maria's brother and another brother was out to kill Tony. Just like accidents. And then Maria was running to tell Tony, sort of, you know, look out, you know, my brother's out there with a gun, he's trying to kill you. And she was looking all over the West Side for Tony, and eventually she saw him, and he was under this lamppost. And as she shouted out, look out, Tony, the brother also saw him and shot him. And Maria ran up to Tony as he was dying. And I don't know why this is, but in the streets of, you know, the West Side, which is a very poor part, you know, of New York, there was an orchestra. And it started playing. And they both, even though he was dying, they didn't call an ambulance, they sang instead. There's a place for us. Somewhere, a place for us. The doomed lovers and Tony died in her arms. And my girlfriend and all the other girls, they were sobbing. They were crying. And all the guys, we were laughing. These stupid girls, don't worry. Tony will be reincarnated in the next showing. It's totally ridiculous. Why do people get involved in that stuff? But people do, and you get involved in your thoughts as well. The same thing. And that's the way, put some space between. It's only thoughts, it's like a movie on a screen. Imagine your mind like a screen, but you're standing back. And then it's very easy to let go of the thoughts. Crazy people. Dear Ajahn Brahm, unkind words can be very hurtful to the person of the receiving end. Can be, but they don't need to be. Sometimes these unkind words are delivered unintentionally. Exactly. If you've got a mouth, you get into trouble sooner or later. The person who speaks it may not realize the hidden dagger behind these words. It is easy to forgive and let go if those are spoken by strangers. What if those words are spoken by friends or someone who's close to us? How should we let go or forgive? Else we can tend to be vengeful towards that person. It's just words. That's why I told you in Singapore a long time ago, that's why you've got two ears. One to go in, one to go out. So if it's stupid words, they go right through. If someone says something really nice to you, say, oh, you're just such a wonderful monk, Ajahn Brahm. I usually put my hand over. So it goes in and stays in. The only reason why you let yourself be hurt by such speech is because you believe that what they're saying might be true. If someone calls you an idiot, the only reason you get hurt is because you think, I might be an idiot. And if you think like that, they were right, you are an idiot. For goodness sake, let it go. How do they know what you are? People have praised me for things I've never done. It's not my fault. Stop praising me. And they blame me for things I haven't done. So all praise and blame is just totally arbitrary, inaccurate. No one really knows. So if they say things which are hurtful, I just sort of in one ear out the other. But usually I get a joke about it. Because it's really funny when people try to upset you and they call you a pig. And you go, And I like pigs. And pigs are delicious. Chinese people like pigs. So if they call you a pig, you say, yeah, you know, it's very, very popular in China, we pigs. We've got a whole year. We haven't got a year of the human. We've got the year of the pig, the year of the... Right? So pigs are very special. But after a while, you know, you don't let yourself be hurt by other people's words. You never allow other people to control your happiness. How does Buddhism explain the beginning of the universe? You see, I told you time goes round and round. When we say practice, what else should we be doing besides sitting? And when we are not engaged in any form of activity, just being here. Become a human being as much as you can in life. You work very hard, you travel places. When you get there, stop a while and enjoy it. Otherwise, your whole life would always be going on to the next thing. Never stopping and enjoying where you've come to. You know, just, life is not a journey. Life is a series of mini journeys with places you could stop and rest on the way. If you don't stop and rest on the way and enjoy it, you're always going on to the next thing. Always doing something. Never stopping and enjoying all that you've achieved so far. And that's what happens, isn't it? We just got a checklist. I get this out of the way. And there's another 10 things you have to get out of the way. And it's always think, once I get this out of the way, then I can relax. Once I do this job, then I can be peaceful. And that, once I get things out of the way, that for many people is their whole life. The whole life is getting things out of the way. You know, you work. I work so I get enough money to get an apartment, pay off my debts. Then you get married. Then you've got big debts. And then you have kids. When you have kids, when my kids grow up, you know, then I can be free. I mean, go to Europe or whatever. By the time the kids grow up, or even when the kids grow up, they have grandkids, and you've got to look after them. It's really terrible being a sort of, these days, you know, that it never ends. You think you've got rid of your kids, and then they have kids, and you're free baby care. You know, because getting childcare is very difficult in any place, but grandparents, free childcare. So grandparents have to look after the kids again, I thought we got rid of you. And then, many times the grandparents think, oh, you know, just when I retire. You know, when I finish working for Singapore Airlines as a captain, all the things I can do, just another year or two when I get out of the way, then I can retire. And by the time you retire, that's when you get so old, you're about to die. And that's why in Singapore, and even in Australia you see most of the people who go to church are old people. Most of the people who go to the temples in Singapore are old people. You know why? Because they think, okay, no, I'll go to the temple, get that out of the way, and then when I die, I can be happy. They go to the temple thinking they have to do that to get happy when they die. Why can't you be happy now? Why do you have to go to the temple to be happy? Or make good karma, so I've got enough good karma. Once I've got that out of the way, then I can be happy. You have enough good karma, every one of you. I shouldn't be saying this to get, otherwise you don't get many donations and food and stuff. But the truth of the matter is, you've already made more than enough donations. Quite frankly, I'm being honest. I'm a bad businessman, but you've already made plenty of donations. You've got loads of good karma. You don't need to make any more. Use it for goodness sake. You've got this huge amount of bank account in your good karma account, but you're not using it. So you always want to make more and more and more and more and more. It's just making more good karma. And you never enjoy it. So you've made so much good karma, everyone here, you've made it to jhana growth. Now enjoy it. Be peaceful. Be happy. Rest. You don't have to work. This is the pause, the rest place in your life. When you go back to Singapore, you're going to have to work your butt off again. But now you don't. So just enjoy every moment of this. Don't think, don't plan, that's more work. Just enjoy. That's beautiful if you can do that. So, learn how to stop. Be. Even though I've got huge amounts of responsibilities, but I just finished my 15-day retreat. I go in my cave, bye-bye world. I don't care what happens, I'm just disappearing. Have a wonderful time. Ajahn Brahm, when the body and mind are calm, it is easy to experience piti sukha after a short sitting. Of course, yes, the piti sukha is happiness. When happiness is experienced, the beautiful breath fades in the background. Exactly. One of the things I never mentioned about Anapanasati, the first four stages of the 16 stages, that's when your focus of attention is the breath. Afterwards, in Anapanasati, 5th, 6th, 7th and 8th, the focus is not the breath, the focus is the happiness. Yeah, it's the breath which is happy, but it's the happiness. That is what you're focusing on, the joy. So your object of meditation is a vedana. It's a feeling. The feeling of peace and happiness with the breath. So, you know, the breath is secondary. And then when you get to the next stages, 9th, 10th, 11th and 12th, that's when you're watching the nimitta. That is what you're watching. So people, what are you watching there? You're not watching the breath. The breath has done its job. It's finished. But it's created this beautiful nimitta, you know, which is a reflection of your mind. You're watching the citta, the mind. That's why it's the next satipatthana. And then when you get into jhanas, people say, well, what are you experiencing in jhanas? Now you're experiencing bliss, real big bliss. So what are you seeing? What are you experiencing? What are you knowing? Bliss. And the four jhanas are different flavors of bliss. Like different flavors of ice cream, vanilla, strawberry, chocolate. What's another one? That's all I know. Anyway, there's just different flavors of bliss. That's what the four jhanas are. So, the awareness is now in piti sukha. When I direct the mind to the beautiful breath, piti sukha quickly becomes less intense. Exactly. So when you've got the piti sukha and the mind automatically focuses on the bliss, just leave it. The mind knows what to do. You don't have to do anything. It will just focus on the piti sukha and the piti sukha will become very intense and beautiful. So the breath has done its job. In the same way, Singapore Airlines can't bring you to jhana growth. You haven't got a landing strip here. All it can do is take you to Perth Airport. It takes you as far as you can go. And then from there you get the bus. And the bus takes you as far as you can go to the car park. And from there you have to walk. And you go as far as you can go in your shoes. And you have to leave your shoes outside. If you want to come into this hall, you leave your shoes outside, you go in your barefoot. So every one of these vehicles can only get you so far. So the breath gets you so far, and then this piti sukha gets you so far, and then seeing the citta gets you so far, and then the jhanas take you the rest of the way to nibbana. But you can't use your breath too far. You have to, it's done its job. No more than can you land a Airbus in this hall. Can't do it. You've got to let it go. So every one of these mind objects, they have its purpose, and when it's done its job, you let it go and you go into something more refined. I'm a few years at this stage and I hope to make progress. Yeah, exactly. So just when you get to the delightful breath, having a wonderful time, just really totally let go there. Let the mind choose what to do. As I used to say, it's like you're driving a car and then, you know, you take your hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, let the car do the rest of the driving. Now there's Google Cars. Google Cars, know, which automatically you just type in the sort of the directions where you want to go, the coordinates, you sit in there and it just goes. And that is a great simile for meditation. You know, I've typed in, I've conditioned and brainwashed you. So I've typed it all in, you sit in the car and just you can't drive it, just go. So meditation is like a Google car. The Google car of the mind. That's what meditation is. Type in the coordinates and the mind does the rest of the job. If we meditate and realize we have fallen asleep and wake up, do we have a break or continue to restart meditation? Just, you know, feel, you know, whether you really need to, your sleep is because you really are tired. If you really fall asleep during meditation and you wake up and you really feel sort of tired, then go to bed any time of the day or night. But sometimes you're meditating and you fall a little bit asleep, but then when you wake up, you're clear, you're fine. So carry on meditating. When you have sleepiness, don't fight it. Sloth and torpor, sleepiness is low energy. The mind, the knower, has got low energy. And if you start doing things, it never regains its energy. So instead, if you've got sleepiness, just please let yourself sleep. Don't fight it. And then the energy starts going into the knower because it's not doing anything. And it's like the mist in the morning when the sun comes up. The mist evaporates. But you don't fight sloth and torpor. You're at peace with it. You know it. You're kind to it. It's like another monster in your palace. Thank you, sloth and torpor, for visiting me. Let's hang out together. And with that type of attitude, sleepiness doesn't last very long. I always had trouble with sleepiness in Thailand in the first few years. And I thought, and I was a bad meditator, there's something wrong with me. And now when I come to Australia, I think, look at that. I was, you know, an Ang Mo English. I wasn't used to that climate. There's no air conditioners in the forest. It was really hot and sticky and close in the jungles. And, you know, we were supposed to only sleep 4 hours a night. And I got it down to 4.5, maybe 4 hours 20. I couldn't do less than that. But even that wasn't enough. You know, you were sleeping. You didn't sleep enough. And I was malnourished, you know, sticky rice and frogs. I was malnourished in a climate I wasn't used to, without enough sleep. And now I look back upon that, even if the Buddha was an Ang Mo eating that food, he would have fallen asleep as well. It was nature. It was cause and effect, nothing to do with me. But because I thought, you know, it was to do with me, I could control and fight it. And so you fight the sloth and torpor and just really try everything to keep awake. You know, one of the things we used to do? The matchbox. It's so hard to fight these things because the body is just so sneaky. So we take a matchbox, take the cover off, so just the tray with all the matches, put it on your head. So just when you did fall over, you know, the matchbox would fall down and you'd know that you were falling asleep. Because you see that when people sleep here, you know, the head goes down. And you know, sometimes you don't know you've been asleep. I remember teaching meditation in a prison once. One of the prisoners started snoring. And one of the prisoners, as he was snoring, because he was asleep, his own snore woke him up. And he said, "Who's snoring? Who's snoring?" And all the others, "You were." He said, "No, I wasn't." "Yes, you were. We heard it." Because when you're asleep, you don't know you're asleep. That's the difficult part. So I put the matchbox on my head thinking, at least I'll know when I fall asleep. And it worked. Now, after a little while, the matchbox never fell off my head. And I thought, I've conquered sloth and torpor. And that's when one of the other monks took me aside and said, "You haven't conquered sloth and torpor. You're just doing it in a different way. Whenever you fall asleep, you go like this." And I was totally unaware of that. It was just the body was so sneaky and so frustrating. And so then I learned, you know, sometimes you'd fight the sloth and torpor, sometimes your willpower was strong enough you'd break through. But I noticed as soon as I broke through the sloth and torpor, my mind was restless. I kept thinking. So I'd calm my thinking down, then you fall asleep. And then you put energy in, and then you'd be restless again. And it was just so frustrating, because I never understood the nature of the mind. Now I understand, you're sleepy, that's nothing to do with you, that's cause and effect. So I'm at peace with my sleepiness. I let it be. When I let it be, I'm not wasting my energies. I'm not doing, I'm just knowing. You don't know very much when you're sleepy, but you can still be aware, yes, I'm sleepy. The thing is, I'm not judging it. Bad monk, you're not supposed to be sleepy. I'm letting it be, I'm being kind to it, opening the door of my heart to my sleepiness. And then after a while, because I let it be with kindness, it never lasts that long. And then once, you know, you wake up, you're peaceful, the restlessness is not there. And you carry on meditating, have great meditation. So this is actually how you deal with that sleepiness. You don't fight it. You just be kind to it. And it doesn't last that long. And when it does go, you're peaceful. If you fight it, when it goes, you're restless. My son told me he is gay. Good on him. Is this bad karma? It's bad karma if you think that there's something wrong with your son. Is this my bad karma, my spouse's bad karma, his own bad karma? Afraid he might get HIV positive in the future. Crikey. You know, straights get HIV as well. You know, anyone can get HIV. Please. You know, we just chanted. You know, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. Whatever living beings they may be, whether they are great or strong, omitting none. The big and the grateful, the gays and the straights. May all beings be happy and well. Isn't gay people part of beings? Aren't they included in your loving kindness? Can't you respect them? And so it's really weird to me as a Buddhist teacher, that parents sort of get upset when their kid is gay. Please love your kid, that's who he is. And don't be ashamed. Tell all your friends, hey, my son is gay. Be proud that your son is gay. Some years ago, someone wrote an article, or published an article in a local paper. It was actually from the Sunday Telegraph in London. It was reprinted here, quoting the Dalai Lama, who said, if you're gay, you can't be a Buddhist. He was totally misquoted, but it was printed out there. And some of my members said, is this true? They said, please tell me it's not true. We thought at least there was one religion, you know, we could follow which respected gay people. I said, of course that's not true. So I wrote another letter to the newspaper, which was published, saying, with all respect to the Dalai Lama, he's wrong on this point. You know, that there's no discrimination in the Buddhist sutras or Buddhist traditions against gay people, women, anybody. And, you know, after that I got all this love mail from the gay community. And I also, and I'm very proud of this, and I got invited to the Gay Pride Breakfast, which was just before the gay Mardi Gras in Perth. And they invited me to give a little talk. And I was so proud of that invitation. It was at Curtin University, my own invitation to the Gay Pride Breakfast. Because they said, thank you for someone sticking up for us and supporting us publicly. Someone who's, you know, that we respect. And so, look, quite frankly, you know, if you reject gays, you're not a Buddhist, as far as I'm concerned. That's putting it on the line. They're part of life. They should be loved and cared for, just like anybody else. Just like women. Are you still discriminated against in Singapore? You know, are you always sort of, you know, you can't get the same salary as a guy gets for the same job? You know, there's some things which you can't do or get into in Singapore. Maybe when you were young, or maybe not as bad these days, but how does that feel as a woman, being treated as second class? You know how that feels? Imagine how gay people feel. worse than that. So when you imagine how it feels, no way you can tolerate that and permit that. And look at the rest of the world. Crikey, you know, we should move on. As Buddhists, we should be leading people, not holding people back. And by the way, I wasn't gay. I had a girlfriend, many girlfriends. So I have to say that, because otherwise I say, oh, he supports gay because he's gay. No way. I was terrified of gays. I could not understand them. And it was actually the fear of them which made me sort of get into discrimination. But once you become a monk and you become wise and you open up your heart, develop compassion, it goes to everybody. Anyway, so I really stick up for anyone, you know, who gets discriminated against. I stuck up for women, so make sure they become bhikkhunis and nuns. I don't care getting into trouble. And I stick up for gays as well. Dear Ajahn, I sometimes have a condition that it was so dark and I cannot breathe and make a sound. It disappears when I chant the three refuges in my heart. What is happening? Fear, that's what's happening. So if a condition is so dark, enjoy it. It's the fear which, you know, makes you sort of want to do some chanting, or you think you can't breathe. The body does the breathing, not you. You can only interfere with it. If the body wants to breathe, it will do. So sometimes that happens. You know, you run out of breath and it stops for a little while. I just let it be. Okay, breath, when you want to sort of come in again, you go in when you want to go in. I know you've been doing this for such a long time. And much of the time, I haven't been aware of what you're up to. I've been busy doing something else, sleeping, messing around or whatever. And I've always trusted you. The breath has always brought oxygen in when I needed it and taking it out. It's done that all my life without fail. So why is it going to stop now? Trust your body to do the breathing so you don't get afraid. And it's dark. Dark is beautiful. I think the Afro said that black is beautiful. Dark. Emptiness. And I know this one guy, he got this black nimitta. Now, as the first guy, someone else got that black nimitta later on. And I said, I never heard that before. I said, what was it like? He said, it was the most beautiful, the deepest of blacks you could ever imagine. Shimmering, rich, black, satin, coal black. And when he described it was obviously really joyful. I said, okay, that's a nimitta. Because the joy in it, the depth of it, a sort of black you can never see in this world. All these blacks are not pure enough, they're not deep, they're not rich, not full enough. That's nimitta stuff. So if it's dark, wow, yes. Enjoy it. But sometimes we add all of our, you know, conditioned responses. Dark is beautiful, black is bad. The dark forces. You know, I went to Cambridge. I'm doing an event in Hong Kong with Richard Gombrich. They've arranged that for March. He's from Oxford. So I call him the professor from the dark side of blue. You know Oxford and Cambridge? Oxford is the dark blues, Cambridge is the light blues. Those are the colours of the university. So, you know, Cambridge, my mob, we're the light blues. And the Oxford are the dark blues. So he's a professor from the dark side of blue. If you ever went to Oxford and Cambridge, you'd get that joke. But you guys obviously didn't get it at all. So if it's dark, just let it be. Dark is beautiful. Change your perceptions. But it's the fear, you know, which makes you clamp up and not enjoy it. But don't let me be afraid, all this stuff, I've been there, done that, and just not enjoy everything. What is the difference between steadfastness and mindfulness? Steadfastness is like stubbornness. It has no wisdom. Sometimes you're so steadfast, standing in the way of accepting gaze. I'm steadfast. But the old traditions, they must be the best. Like beating your wives. Is that a good tradition? Is it? Is it a good tradition having more than one wife? That used to be the tradition in the old days. Is that? Be steadfast. preserve your culture. Just no one would do that. So sometimes there is a time for being steadfast with wisdom and kindness. But steadfastness by itself, it can be just so stubborn and just cause so much problems. You know, I'm not going to change. I'm not going to sort of reconsider. I've made up my mind and that's it. And that type of steadfastness is called stubbornness. It's a huge problem in our world. So mindfulness is we're aware in the present moment, silent, so we're open to new ways of looking at things. So mindfulness is where we can actually grow and learn more. Steadfastness is closing all the doors, locking us in the past, locking us in stuff which is way past its use by date. When a family man decides to walk the path of a monk, does that constitute abandonment of responsibilities to his family? If it did, then the Buddha had no filial piety and did a bad deed when he left home. Did I abandon my responsibilities to my family because I became a monk? Am I a bad guy? Am I? What would have happened if I said, no, I've got to look after my mother. I cannot become a monk. Then you'd have no jhana growth. You'd have no silly jokes in the evening. Well, if a family man decides to walk the path of a monk, it doesn't necessarily constitute abandonment of responsibilities to his family. What he does is make sure his family are well looked after, first of all. Make sure, you know, they have enough money there, a place, the kids are okay. And then, okay, fair enough, with permission of his wife and kids, off he goes to become a monk. Many people do that. Same with you girls. Now is the opportunity for you to walk the path as well, not just men. Dhammasara Nuns Monastery. And many other opportunities are opening up for women now in Buddhism. So, if you decide, yeah, now with husband's okay with this idea, kids are sort of, you know, pretty independent, off you go, become a nun. What a wonderful time it is to be alive. And for the first time in such a long, many centuries, the women's order is growing strong, established again at last. So it's not just the men, you can become a monastic too. Isn't that cool? Many of you, you know, you've been with your husband, been with the family, you know, you've done that. Brought up your kids. Now how are you going to spend the rest of your life? Some of you might think, yeah, I would like to try out being a monk, being a nun. You try it out, for many of you it just won't work. It's not who you are, but some of you, you try that like I did, and straight away, wow, this is who I am, this is what I want to be. And you can become great nuns, great monks, and serve Singapore. So that means I won't have to travel all this way to help you, have your own. You won't have to import monks and nuns anymore. You can be an exporter. But Singapore likes being an exporter, not an importer. Religion is like blind faith and hearsay? Something, I can't read the last word. Religion is like blind faith. Blind faith is absolutely stupid. Because if you're blind, you don't know where you're going. And you have faith. You know, who can you have faith in these days? Politicians? The police? Can you have... This is a crisis of faith because, I don't know about in Singapore, but right now in Australia, there is a Royal Commission into the sexual abuse of religious authorities, including the Protestant Church, the Catholic Church. Fortunately, we weren't here at the time, it was just the new boys on the block, so that, you know, we're not involved in this. But, you know, this is destroying people's faith when the people they trusted, the priests and the nuns, sexually abused 10-year-olds. This I read today, that, you know, some of these kids, and this is in a community in outside Darwin somewhere, you know, they were sexually abused so badly they had to wear nappies to school to stop the blood going on their school uniform. And I said, it's gross. And these were priests. You know, people who had the respect of the community, people who were the leaders of faith. And it's just, it's sick. But because of that, the people have lost sort of, you know, their blind faith. And it's about time you do lose your blind faith. You don't trust somebody just because they're a monk or a nun. You check them out first of all. You know, like, you know, you guys checked me out when I first went to Singapore. Who is this guy? Is he the real thing? Now, how does he behave when he's not in public? That's, you know, it's good you do check out your priests and your leaders. Because if not, you know, blind faith gets abused. Fortunately, the, you know, religion, you know, has to sort of be accountable. At last, it is accountable. You can't get away with such abuse anymore. And, you know, that means that people don't have blind faith, they have wisdom instead. Do you think it necessary to make a religion out of truth and a path to truth, given there are many bad concepts around? Religion is like blind faith, it's at the back of the question. To make a religion out of truth, I mean, sometimes people used to ask me, they've asked me this on radio recently, they asked me, is Buddhism a religion? Because, you know, it doesn't have a god at its center. And for most people, people think religion means belief in some sort of god. And I told them on radio, this was ABC, Australian Broadcasting Corporation, I say, Buddhism is a religion, for tax purposes anyway. Because you get sort of advantages if you're a religion. But, you know, yeah, there was a debate in the House of Lords, I forget when, but it was maybe 30, 40 years ago, House of Lords in Britain. And that is, you know, a parliament of people who really know what they're talking about. It's a very high standard of debate. You know, it's not like some of the stuff I hear from the Parliament of Australia or the House of Commons these days, where people are just calling each other bad names, like in the schoolyard. This was actually a very, very high-powered intellectual debate. And they decided in the end that, you know, that the word religion has to change. And not to be God-centered, but to actually to include things like Buddhism, which has all of the other qualities of a religion. You know, people using that as a way of life or to guide their decisions in life, which has some sort of meaning just beyond, you know, the life in this world, which has, you know, an afterlife and a belief in what happens afterwards, which has its churches, monks, priests, you know, which has things like precepts, which has rituals. For many people it is a religion. It counts as a religion. And why not? Because, you know, it is just a way of taking these teachings and saying that this is a religion, it is a way of life, it is a path which we can trust and believe in and make use of to become better human beings. So, yeah, it is a religion. The truth. And again, the religion is not the truth. The religion is supposed to lead people to the truth. Religion is not the truth, but shows you how to get there. And that's why one of my favorite sayings is never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Because so often in life, whether you're a physicist, a philosopher, a Buddhist who's got read all the sutras backwards and forwards, doesn't matter, all that education, all that knowledge, don't let it stand in the way of truth. If you come across something which totally is opposite to everything you've told, don't bend the facts to fit your beliefs. Bend your beliefs to fit the facts. And too often in life, religions or the religion of science. Science is really guilty of this these days. They bend the truth to fit their belief in science. And a good example of that, if you haven't seen it yet, there was a TEDx video of Rupert Sheldrake. Rupert Sheldrake, you know, he's from the light side, not the dark side, he's from Cambridge. But, you know, he's a real scientist who's always questioning everything. And one of the things he was questioning, I mean, I think some of you can remember some of your school science, law of gravity. This is not Einstein's special theory, but Newton's law of gravity. The attraction between two massive bodies is equal to the product of their mass divided by the square of their distance apart, multiplied by the universal gravitational constant, big G. And you learn that at school. And this guy said, well, is big G a constant, or does it change? And if it did change, that's a fundamental assumption of physics is challenged. The things which people just take for granted. Now, there are many scientific institutions funded by governments which all they do, you know, is just measure these quantities. You know, they try and measure the speed of light. They measure big G. They measure the electric charge of an electron. They keep on just measuring things. And so he got all the data he could from all over the world, all these labs in Canada, US, Britain, France, and other places, which actually measured big G. They said, oh, you found this out. We're trying to keep it a secret. Big G has changed. It keeps on changing. It is not a constant. Or the speed of light. It's supposed to be a constant. He got all the data, and the speed of light has been changing. And this totally undermines the theories of science on which other assumptions are based. You know, you've heard that so many times on TV, and light, speed of light is constant. Big G is constant. These things aren't supposed to change. But he found they have. And he was using this as an argument on TEDx channel that he said the scientific method should be distinguished from scientific dogma. Scientific method is that the way they're always challenging, always arguing. And if the evidence clearly is against the assumptions, you have to follow the evidence and give up all the old theories. No matter how cherished and fundamental it is, you have to give up the fact that big G is a constant. Because the evidence is convincing. It's not a constant. But he said that is scientific dogma. Scientists will not accept that. Big G is a constant. They've been taught that, and they just ignore the evidence. And he said science is a dogma. And a few weeks later, his talk got taken off TEDx. The only talk ever to be taken off TEDx channel. And he replied, see, I was right. Science is dogmatic. They banned me. And it was once, you know, the guys who were in charge, they got so embarrassed that, you know, they'd have actually just proved his point and they put him back on again. But, you know, that's the problem. Even science, the stuff you hear at school is not right. But you tell a scientist that and say, no, what are you talking about? Of course it's right. So many assumptions. And that he was a real scientist, and I thought, wow, great, that's what science is. So even science is dogmatic. Science has become a religion. You don't question the experts. And people say, oh, but it has peer review. They say, that's the great strength of science, it's peer review. Just like Lehman Brothers had peer review. Other accountants in that company, they looked at the accounts, oh, yeah, that's right. Peer review is not good enough. You need outside people to check your results. Now, auditors cannot, you know, in our Buddhist society, auditors cannot be Buddhists. You know, because that's against the law in Australia. If we get our accounts audited, it has to be someone outside of our group. Otherwise, it's conflict of interest. Peer review is conflict of interest. That's why I just really challenge science. Anyway, that's one of my little things. Dear Ajahn, when is the right time to let go versus putting up a fight? The story of one of the school teachers in Burma's Second World War. And he was on a patrol in Burma. Remember that story? Great story. He was wandered into the jungle with a group of British soldiers, and the scout came back, said they'd stumbled into a huge number of Japanese troops. They were completely surrounded and outnumbered, at war in Burma. If they surrendered, they'd just get tortured. If they put up a fight, they'd get killed. So what should you do? And this is a real problem. War. And so this guy, my friend who was a school teacher, he thought, let's fight. That's what men do. Let's be Bruce Willis in the jungle. Die hard. So, that's what he thought. He's going to be the hero. But you know, it's an army, so you have to follow orders. The captain said, no, we will not fight. We will all sit down and have a cup of tea. And it's a great story. I'm sure you've heard it before. It's opening the door of the heart. It's one of the key stories in there. And this guy, you know, I was a young school teacher, just joined school, and he was this old one about to retire. And he said that he could not believe the captain having a cup of tea when you're about to die in the jungles of Burma at war. And he thought it's the craziest thing he's ever been told to do. But, you know, orders are orders. He had to follow it. He thought, this is madness. So they sat down and had a cup of tea. Before they finished, the scout came back and told them, the enemy's moved. There's a way through. Put everything away. Which they did very quickly. And they crawled through the gap in the surrounding forces. And that's why he could tell the tale. They all survived. No injuries. And he told that story to me is what saved his life so many times. When you're surrounded by the enemy, and there's no way out, and there's nothing to do, what do? Sit down and have a cup of tea. Have a cup of coffee. Have some noodles. I don't care what you want. Except in the afternoon and evening, okay? You sit down and have a cup of tea. Because when there's nothing to do, that's when you let go. And then you find the world is always changing. Situations are always in flux. And if you are waiting, ready, when there is something to do, there's a way out, then you're ready to take it, you escape. The problem is with most people, they just always fight, 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 fight. They never know when it's the best thing to do. Just stay still, do nothing, wait until you can be effective. So the first thing to do, we have to all have to learn how to sit still and do nothing when we're surrounded by the enemy, about to die, or even worse. To be able to do nothing, that's where we learn how to let go. If you learn that in this meditation, you'll be so effective in life. Because you won't waste all your energies and make the situation worse. And then, when there's something to do, you've got all your energy, it's all preserved, you can take it and you escape from so many problems in life. The trouble is, in Singapore, in Australia, you only know how to do things. You don't know how to sit down and do nothing. So you learn that here. Sometimes when I meditate, my head will twist and spin. Somebody told me that happened in The Exorcist. Wow, you're possessed. The devil has come in to John. Sometimes when I meditate, I've never seen that movie, obviously. I think it was after my time, but people told me about it. Sometimes when I meditate, that's actually, I don't know how they did that in real life. Special effects, I suppose. Anyway, sometimes when I meditate, my head will twist and spin, and on a few occasions I felt giddy for a few days after that, just like a hangover feeling. I swear I didn't drink. Well, how do you know it's like a hangover feeling then? Caught you. What's happening? Okay. It will twist and spin, but sometimes, number one, always look at physical problems, first of all. Make sure you're drinking enough liquids, know, to keep your brain hydrated, otherwise it can become a bit spinny or something. So make sure the physical things are right, first of all. Make sure the room is not too hot, because sometimes that makes one a bit giddy sometimes. So try all the physical things first of all. Make sure you know, haven't got a bug or something, you know, some sort of little fever or flu or something. Check all the physical things first of all. And if it's nothing physical, then sometimes it might be just twisting and spinning. It may be this stage, which I've told a few people, where your perception becomes free of constraints. And there's already one person said they felt themselves expanding or floating up into the air when they were meditating. You don't float up into the air, you don't expand. I think I mentioned that the other day, that's why I was fat. Remember that joke? You don't do that, but that's what it feels like. And many times people have told me, said, no, I really was spinning, I was twisting around, I was rocking. And you know, I've actually said, okay, I'm going to keep my eyes open the next meditation and watch you. And then after say, did you see it? I was rocking. I said, you were perfectly still, madam. They don't believe me. So these days, if you have that idea, we'll get one of the smartphones and take a video of you. It feels like you are rocking. It feels like you are spinning. It feels like sometimes you're floating in the air, but you're perfectly still. It's perception playing around. It's just what happens at that stage of meditation. All of your restrictions, your attachments, your grasping to one form of perception are let go of. You can start to see things in different ways. It's fun. It only lasts for a few minutes and then it goes. Please explain. Consciousness is the seed, craving the moisture, karma the field. This is about rebirth. So consciousness is the seed, in other words, the stream of consciousness going from one life to another. Without the craving, the moisture, there's nothing to give it oomph, nothing to keep it going. And karma the field means if you made lots of good karma, then you get reborn in a beautiful field and you grow strong and wonderful. Otherwise, if you've got bad karma, you get reborn in a nuclear waste dump and you get all mutated. And so the karma will affect just how you grow. So this is just one way of talking about the way of rebirth, reincarnation, in brief, because it's getting late. Last question. Does one need morality to be able to achieve jhana? Why did Devadatta manage to have psychic power in the first place, although he lost it later? Due to something use? Some monk use? At which stage in jhana that one would let go of all cravings and desires so that one would never turn to evil? Okay, morality, your precepts, your goodness, your kindness, your generosity, that empowers your mind. It gives it strength. When you break precepts, it actually makes it weak. You know, you don't have so much mental strength. And after a while you see this. When you get mindful, and then when you break a precept, you do something stupid, then you can actually see its effect on your mind. And the other thing which you see very clearly, this is actually you perceive this, when nimittas come up, these lights, if you're a really good-hearted person, pure person, never argue with other people, never play politics with societies, always kind, beautiful, always there, but you never ask for any sort of favors for yourself, what we call pure-hearted people, they're always there for you, always kind. They never push themselves forward, they never ask for anything, but they're always there to give and help and serve. Really kind, good, compassionate people. When their nimitta comes up, it's gorgeous. Beautiful. And here in Perth, I know who the really nice people are. They're always there to help out. But they never sort of push themselves forward, they're never proud. And I know those people, I know that when they get a nimitta, wow, they're really going to enjoy it. Because they built it up with all their morality, their virtue, their kindness, their generosity, their compassion. And you can't fake it. You know, there are some people just really kind, good people. They never harm you at all. They're always there for you. Even if they're tired, they will sort of spend time with you, looking after you. This is the payback. Their mind, because when you get to the nimitta stage, you're seeing your mind as it really is. And if you built up all that morality, your citta is, your nimitta is radiant. It's really strong and so beautiful, because you're a really beautiful person. The opposite of that is if you've been selfish, you're mean, you know, just nasty to somebody, you know, then when the nimitta comes up, it's like a dirty rag, stained. And I always remember the first time I told that, you know, shared it with people in Kuala Lumpur. This young man came up afterwards and he was really concerned. He said, "I've got to talk to you." He said, "Well, what happened?" "My nimitta came up and it was stained all over the place." "Ah, what am I doing?" I said, "Have you been keeping your precept?" "Well, you know, well, sort of, but..." And he actually saw the results of, you know, not keeping precepts and being selfish or being cruel. You know, before you get to nimitta stage, you can't see that, but when you get there, it's very clear. So when you get morality and generosity, kindness, compassion, forgiveness, all of that stuff has a real effect on your mind, and you get its benefit when you get to that stage in meditation. So it makes it much easier to get into jhanas. It's not impossible, because as a monk, sometimes I feel, you know, out of compassion, I'm like a lawyer, I tell you all the loopholes. You know, how to get into jhana even though you may not be keeping your five precepts. You know, I don't mind saying that, because there is a way, you know, you can get around it. It's the sneaky way, because I know what I'm doing here. What you do, you see, you know, your mind like the dirty rag, because you've been messing around. But it's not all dirty, there's always parts of it which are clean. So you focus on the clean bit, you know, not the bad bricks in the wall, the good bricks in the wall. And when you develop a positive attitude like that, it's not hard to do. See the beautiful part. And in the beautiful part, that tends to expand, just like the TV simile. And in that part, you look at the most beautiful part of the beautiful part. And the most beautiful part of the most beautiful part of the most beautiful part. You keep on doing that, and soon your mind, your nimitta gets very brilliant and beautiful. You can do that even if you're being a bad person or being naughty. So it can be done, that's the loophole. But it's much easier if you keep your precepts. So what happened with Devadatta? You know, he was obviously had a lot, you know, of good karma, you know, being a Buddha's cousin. So he got his jhanas, he got his psychic powers, but he had too much conceit. You know, he thought that was, you know, his enlightenment, he was as good as a Buddha, he wanted to take over. There's that conceit, it's owning your attainments. That's what destroyed them. It's the pride. And so he lost them after that, and that was the end of him. So remember, to stop that that problem, these aren't attainments, these are stages of letting go. There's nothing to do with you. It's not like getting a degree from university when it's, you know, saying that Stefan got the degree. You haven't got anything. This is what you lose, and that's where you get the jhanas from. You don't own them. You don't take them as a personal achievement. And then these jhanas, they lead to enlightenment rather than just more ego. "I'm better than you are. You've only got second jhana, I've got third jhana, na 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 na." People who think like that will lose their jhanas. It's not a personal attainment. And that's also the reason why anyone who does get attainments or these stages of, they never tell you. It's another reason, Angie, why people don't tell you, because no one attains anything. I often tell people that. I make my confessions. I'm honest with you. Ajahn Brahm cannot meditate. Ajahn Brahm cannot get jhana. I said it, oh goodness. Now you know. Ajahn Brahm can't get jhana. Oh my goodness. I've let you know. What am I going to do now? It's true. Cross my heart. Ajahn Brahm can't get jhanas. Ajahn Brahm has to disappear first. When Ajahn Brahm is gone, then the jhanas happen. Do you get the understanding? If I want to attain something, the I gets in the way. I can't do it. When I vanish, then the jhanas come. That's the whole idea of attainment. To say someone is an arahat, that's why if someone comes up and says, I am an arahat, fully enlightened, I know for true that they're not. That's not it. In the time of the Buddha, there was a sutta there, and this couple of monks came up to the Buddha. First one said, someone who's fully enlightened, they don't think they're better, they're worse, or the same as anybody else. And we said, yes, correct. And another monk said the same. One who's enlightened, is it the case they don't think they're better, they don't think they're worse, they don't think the same? He said, yes, said the Buddha. Then the Buddha turned around to Ananda, he said, those were two enlightened beings. That's how an enlightened being says they're enlightened. They've just got no self left. They're not better, they're not worse, they're not the same. There's just no one there. So who's there to be enlightened? When I was recently in Sri Lanka, I'm very famous in Sri Lanka, and on TV, in one of the best monasteries over there, and on TV, someone asked me the question on TV, a monk, put me on the spot. Ajahn Brahm, are you an arahat? It's on TV. What can I do? So I said, if you can tell me, you know, who's the arahat, whether it's my rupa, my body, this fat old body, or whether it's my vedana, or my sanya, or my sankhara, or my vijnana, and which particular vijnana it is, whether it's the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, or mind vijnana, if you can tell me which one of those is an arahat, then I can answer you. There's no one there, these are just processes. No one is an arahat. Which process, which of the khandhas is a arahat? So when you understand what's going on, actually they really like the answer. So when you understand what's going on, the idea of me, an I, a being, being enlightened, it is ridiculous. You vanish, and then enlightenment happens. The art of disappearing. So when you get that, you understand this whole path is letting go. Letting go of everything until there's nothing you own and there's nothing to define you, there's nothing left. That's the arahat. You disappear. So anyone says, I've got jhana. No, you haven't. Well, it's not going to last if you speak like that. So that was Devadatta's problem. No, he owned his jhanas, thought it was an attainment, made a self out of it, and it just vanished. He didn't quite get it. So that's why I say Ajahn Brahm can't meditate. Ajahn Brahm vanishes, bye-bye Ajahn Brahm, bye-bye me, and then all these incredible things happen. Do you understand that? If you do, you're getting really far on in the path. Well done. Okay, so Ajahn Brahm is now going to really disappear. I'm going home. So, here we go, a nice deep evening. Not so many jokes, but lots of interesting Dhamma. You ready? 1, 2, 3. Sadhu! Sadhu! Sadhu!